Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a little time as we go through the classic and sometimes not so classic cardboard that we find in our closets, in our storage units, or pristinely saved in some plastic page that we assembled many, many years ago. And we've got a lot going on in this week's show, so we're going to get right to it as we take a look at not only 83 Donruss, a set that you, the listeners, chose in our pack pick earlier this week, but also some of the struggles that the Donruss and Fleer sets had in the early 80s, why that was the case. And we'll also talk about some interesting topics that came up on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, including an answer to the question, where did Topps get a picture of Willie Mays sliding into home plate, yet they doctored it and called it Henry Aaron for the 1956 set? We do have an answer on that. And also, a little interesting sidebar on the 1959 Fleer Ted Williams set, as I had a listener get a little upset with the choice of words that I used to describe the set, but some clarity on that and a little bit of discussion on that as well. Now, before we get into that, again, just a reminder that we are on Twitter 24/7 at Wax and Gum Stains, and a lot of the topics we're talking about in this episode come from conversations that came through Wax and Gum Stains. So I strongly suggest, if you aren't already following, go ahead and do so. Give us a follow. That is where our video links to pack breaks happen, and you can watch the break of the 83 Donruss wax packs that we did yesterday, and also all of our previous wax pack or cello pack breaks that we've done over the last few months, but also the discussion. That's really the big thing there. So if you're not already following at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, please do, and pass along the link to your friends. Also, let your friends know that we are coming to you every other Friday throughout the off season. So our next show will be 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, November the 16th. And we come your way through Audioboom, but also several other platforms, notably iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. And there are several other ways, other connections to all of those connections and all those RSS feeds. So just type in Wax Ecstatic into your web browser, or chances are you're using Google anyways. Type in Wax Ecstatic, you will find the link there. And you will also find our archive, which stretches back several years ago. So we've gone through practically every major set that's been released to North America since 1950. So check out the archives when you get a chance. And again, the show coming your way every other week, so you can mark your calendar and say, hey, I've got another Wax Ecstatic coming down the pike. You can also subscribe to the podcast through those various platforms. And like I said, if you follow us on Wax and Gum Stains, that's the best way to get the links, get the shows as soon as they come out. And lastly, just want to remind you that we also appreciate your cash donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you have donated, thank you so much. I appreciate your contributions. If you haven't, if you have just a few dollars, that's all we're asking for. We've received donations of $5, $2. That's totally fine. We appreciate every dollar that comes in. And a reminder that that money goes not into my bank account for my lavish spending. No, there's no lavish here. It goes right back into the program in two ways. One, to keep our base, our database, our collection of podcasts together via Audioboom. There is a subscription fee for us to keep it there. So that's how we keep the new shows and the archives alive for you. But also, we take that money to purchase cards that we discuss on this show, whether it's single cards like we've done recently with a deep dive into some of the early and mid-1950s cards, or if it's purchases of packs. And I'm actually on the prowl for PAX right now. The last card show I went to a couple weekends ago, my friend and I got there a little too late. They were about an hour away from closing the show, so a lot of the dealers are starting to pack things up. So the normal selection of wax packs and rack packs I can get my hands on, because this was the last hour of day two of the show, well, they're long gone. So I didn't have a chance to get those. Although I will say, I got some pretty good deals on some older rookie cards, Kirby Puckett and Andre Dawson, Dennis Eckersley, also a half-decent 65 tops Willie Stargell, mainly because the dealers were just happy to make a sale before they closed. So word of advice there, if you're going out to a card show and you do procrastinate and you're not able to get to the show until an hour or two before closing time, you can get some pretty good deals if you kind of know what you're looking for and you're able to get in, pick it out, and get out with a bargain. But anyways, as it goes back to the PayPal account there, any donations that are received go right back into the show, and I am looking for some packs. I've got my eyes on some from the mid to late 70s. A lot of auctions on eBay for those. Crossing my fingers, I can luck out and sneak into one of these auctions where I can get the pack for a decent price, as there's been a little bit of a flood of some of these packs, and they're coming from reputable dealers too. So I think because the market has risen and the value of these packs has gone up recently, I think some dealers were very wisely sitting on these for a few years, and now they can get them out there, and hopefully I can get one for you at a decent price, and we can open it up in a future show. So again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you've donated, thanks. If not, if you have a few bucks, whether it's $2, $5, $20, whatever, know that your money is going right back into the program, and we certainly appreciate anything that you can donate. Now, this week's show, we offered up from the pack collection an interesting trio of options. I had three 83 Donruss wax packs. I have the 85 top cello pack, which still, despite having a Mark McGwire rookie, or the chance of having a Mark McGwire rookie in it, or a Puckett rookie, or a Roger Clemens rookie, even though that possibility is there, we still haven't gotten enough votes to get it. There's always another option that somehow just beats out 85 tops. And then I had an 89 top cello pack. I put it in there. I have no idea why. Maybe because I'm just, you know, a fan of the design. Or maybe I'm running low on options. Actually, I'm not. I can tell you the next pack option that I have, that one's going to be very tough for our listeners to choose from, because they're all packs that we've selected from before, but there are some that are real favorites of fans. So you have to stay tuned for that. I don't know if I'll be doing that the next show or the following show, but sometime within the next month, we will do that. But anyways, the options this week, 83 Donruss, 85 tops, 89 tops. To no surprise, 83 Donruss wins because it is the older of the three. But there was a tight race between 83 Donruss and 85 tops. 89 tops, I think, got 6% of the vote. But 83 tops edges out 83 Donruss, rather, edges out 85 tops 51% to 43%, like I said, the remaining 6% go into 89 tops there. And it immediately sparked a conversation about why 83 Donruss was so bad. Why were a lot of the cards from the early 80s so bad? And we'll get into that in just a moment. I'm going to give you a little bit of a background of not only Donruss, but just the hobby scene in the early 80s that explains a lot of why some of those early sets from Donruss and Fleer were clunkers. And there's some pretty good reasons why, and I think you'll understand that. And you'll also understand why the holy trinity of rookies from 1983, that of course Ryan Sandberg, Tony Gwynn, and Wade Boggs, much like Cal Ripken Jr. saved the 1982 sets, those three players helped save some of the weaker sets in 83, primarily Donruss, although Fleer had a pretty good effort in that year, and Topps put out a very, very popular set that is still highly regarded 35 years later. So we'll get to that in a moment, but I want to tie up some loose ends from our previous episode, as we had some interaction with some of our listeners on a couple of topics. One was in regards to the 1956 Topps Henry Aaron card, or Hank Aaron, as it says on the card. But the question brought up by one of our listeners, Heavy J, asked about the background photo that is used, or the action shot that is used on the Aaron card in the 56 Topps set. He asked if the story is true that it's not Hank Aaron sliding into home plate in the action shot, but is it Willie Mays? And I said, yes, it absolutely is Willie Mays. It's very well known that Topps, for whatever reason, decided to use the stock photo of Willie Mays sliding into home plate, and they just airbrushed it to make it look like it was a member of the Milwaukee Braves in action. And there's really no official backstory to it. From all the research that I've done, there's really no official explanation as to why that is. And also, because we're talking about an incident that happened 62 years ago, many of the people who would have been involved in that decision-making process are either A, dead, or B, they don't have a story to tell. They don't recall that story. And what is very likely, as I discussed in last episode, is that it was just a common practice. It's like, hey, we need an action shot. We don't really have anything good with Aaron here. Oh, well, you know, here's another black player. Why don't we paint it up here and put it in? I know that's a very crude thought there, but again, you know, mid-1950s, Topps just needs to, you know, produce this card, and well, let's find somebody that looks like Henry Aaron, and they'll never know the difference. And I'm sure for many people, they had no idea. But the question was, where did they get this picture? And we have actually found the picture. In fact, it was Heavy J, thank you very much, kind of doing your own homework in conjunction with us to track down this picture. And we do feature that picture on the timeline for Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. You'll have to scroll down a bit, because it was discovered several days ago. Now, I had mentioned in the show last time around that I have access to photographs for the AP Sportswire and also Getty Images. And despite all of these pictures that I had to comb through, I couldn't find that exact photo. But I found a photo that appeared to be taken about a half a second before the photo that was used on the 56 Topps card. And I made that choice, or that assumption, not based on the action of Willie Mays sliding into the plate, but actually using the home plate umpire as my basis of deductive logic, going, you know, okay, well, he's holding his mask here, and if you look at the picture there, it looks like that's the next thing that happens. So I assumed, all right, this action shot, and it was from a game in May of 1952. This is likely the game that picture was taken from. Well, Heavy J did the heavy lifting, if you will, and somehow found the French version of the Getty Sports images. I don't know how he got it, but he found the exact picture. And what do you know? We were both right. He found the exact picture that was used by Topps, and it was from the same game of the picture that I had found. So my assumption that my picture was taken about a half second before the action shot that was used for the 56 Hank Aaron Topps card was also accurate. So it was actually kind of neat to take the two pictures and kind of look at them back and forth. But there's no doubt that this photograph that is in the French archive of the Getty Sports Images actually is the shot used by Topps. Again, exactly why Topps used that photo, we don't know. The best assumption is that they just didn't have enough action shots of Hank Aaron in 1956. Remember, at this time, you know, this would have been the winter of 1955 going into 56 when Topps is producing these. Topps had made a couple of cards for Hank Aaron before his rookie card coming in 1954, but they didn't have like a true action shot. They used action shots in 55, but that was more staged action shots. In 56, they were colorizing actual photographs of players in action and using that as the backdrop for these cards. So they may just not have had a whole lot of pictures of Henry Aaron, even though his star was rising and the Milwaukee Braves as a team were rising going into the 56 season. Again, it's Milwaukee, and Topps was based in New York. That's where a lot of their photography was taken, is at Yankee Stadium or the Polo Grounds, in some cases Ebbets Field. But, you know, they probably just had limited photographs of the Braves in New York and just nothing really exciting with Henry Aaron. So they said, well, we'll just use this picture. And again, it's kind of crude. They're like, well, just find a dark-skinned player and we'll just dress up the uniform and make it look like him. And, you know, that was just business in 1956. And they just got it done. They got the card out there. But now we have solved the riddle. While we don't know exactly why they did it, we know the picture that they got it from, and it was a game in May of 1952 that was just sitting around in the Topps archives, which they utilized for the background of the Hank Aaron card. So great work there, Heavy. Great question. It was a lot of fun researching it, and together we were able to find that answer there, and I really appreciate your help with that. Now, Heavy J would also contribute to a lot of the discussion for this week's current set from the packs that we chose, the 83 Donruss. We'll get to that in just a moment, but one other question stemming from the show, the last episode that came out a couple weeks ago, from Robert Lawson, and he writes, "You mentioned the 1959 Fleer set. Not sure I agree that it depicts a boring day in the life of Ted Williams or that the Red Sox word mark could not be shown. It might be a fun set to devote a future show to, however, not too expensive." Now, what Robert is referring to is just kind of an off-the-cuff statement that I had mentioned about the 1959 Ted Williams set that Fleer put out, and I'll give you a little bit of the backstory of that. I don't think I'll be able to devote an entire episode to it, Robert, simply because A, I don't have any of the cards. B, I'm really not in the market to go out and obtain the whole set, although I will keep an eye out for some of the cards. But let me first clarify something that I said. I called the set, or before I talk about the boring comment, I said that the set couldn't use the Red Sox word mark, and I stand corrected. That's one of those things where I'm just saying it off the top of my head, and I didn't even think to look at a picture of it. So my bad. That's a mistake I should have prevented by actually looking at the car before just spouting it off the top of my head. But again, it's just one of those off-the-cuff statements there. But the word boring was used, and I said, you know, the 59 Topps or the 59 Fleer Ted Williams set was boring and not very popular, and you take umbrage to that. And let me just give you some context to it. I think in 1959, it was a boring set, and I'll tell you more about that. In all honesty, when you're looking at the set now, nearly 60 years later, it's actually a work of art. It's a very well-designed set, and Fleer had the best of intentions of putting it together. But I came up with the word boring because collectors back in 1959, and of course back then, probably 95% of the people collecting baseball cards were teenagers or young kids, the kids didn't want the life story of Ted Williams for a number of reasons. One, they wanted action shots. They wanted cards of every baseball player, not just Ted Williams. And also, you know, kids are looking at some of these cards that came out. While there are some very interesting moments like Ted hitting 400 or Ted hitting the game-winning home run in the 1941 All-Star Game, the Triple Crown year. Even though all of this stuff is out there, there's also cards that are like, you know, Ted goes into the military and Ted wins this award. Here's Ted fishing. So the subject matter for, you know, put yourself in your shoes back when you were 8, 9, 10 years old. Probably not very interesting stuff when you were a kid. And that was part of the problem Fleer had. Fleer had a lot of problems with the set. But that was part of the problem that Fleer had, in 1959 was that they put out this very unique set, but it was met with a collective yawn from a lot of collectors who, again, the primary collector age then was probably 12, because, you know, kids just wanted, you know, action shots and pictures of all of their favorite baseball players, not just the life story of Ted Williams. And especially if you're not a Boston Red Sox fan or a fan of Ted Williams, why would you care? You know, think of all the other stars from 1959. You've got Mickey Mantle. You've got Willie Mays. You've got Hank Aaron. You know, you've got all these other bigger name stars. Not that Ted Williams wasn't big, but certainly by 1959, his career is winding down, and you've got a lot of other players from that era who are in the prime of their career. So I think the collector back then was looking more at the current stars and less the life story of one of the greatest hitters of all time. And I also think something that sets that set apart, and why we can look at it in 1959 and go, eh, and we can look at it now and go, wow, this is actually a pretty interesting set, is just the context of history. You know, in 1959, yeah, Ted Williams was still a very popular baseball player. Yes, he had finally won over a lot of the fans and the media in Boston. He clashed with fans and media for much of his career. And it wasn't until the final three or four seasons of his playing career that the tables turned a little bit, and there was actually a little bit of respect shown from both sides, both Ted and the collective media and fan base in the Northeast. And yes, you know, Ted Williams still had a lot of name equity, and you know, he was a very popular player, and that's why Fleer went after him, one of many reasons. But I don't think even in 1959 you could have realized how great Ted Williams was. And that is, of course, because you had a lot of other great ball players at that time. You had Mickey Mantle, but you also had Ted's archenemy in the Yankees, Joe DiMaggio. So, you know, Joe DiMaggio is still alive and well and kicking and, you know, still living the life in New York City, you know, well after his playing days in the late 50s. But, you know, Ted Williams was still being overshadowed a little bit by Joe DiMaggio. You know, Babe Ruth had been dead for only 13 years or 11 years, I think, you know, not that long afterwards. So, you know, the ghost of Babe Ruth is still kind of overshadowing some of the great players of the time there. Even though Ted Williams was great in 1959, I don't think people realized how great he was, and you don't realize it until many, many years later. You know, Ted Williams, you know, hitting .406 in 1941, I don't know if anybody ever hits .400 again. There have been a few players over the years that have tempted that. They've come tantalizingly close, but especially with how the game has changed under sabermetrics and other advanced statistics, you know, the chances of one player playing in 162 games and playing, you know, getting enough at bats, you know, enough plate appearances, 3 to 4 at bats in a game to perhaps even qualify for hitting 400, and oh, by the way, being talented enough to hit 400. You know, now, you know, we've gone 7 years since that's happened. And it's going to be 78 because nobody did it this year. Nobody came close. So with time, now you realize the greatness of Ted Williams. In 1959, yeah, he was pretty good. But now you don't, you know, until now, you don't realize how incredible he was. And that goes not only for Ted Williams in 1959. Mark my word, 20, 25 years from now, you're going to look at some of the star players from today, and you're going to go, you know, that guy was pretty good, but I didn't realize how good he was. I think you're going to look at guys like Mike Trout. I think you're going to look at guys like Max Scherzer. Of course, you know, Clayton Kershaw is very popular now, but, you know, I don't think, you know, as the game changes, I don't think we're really going to appreciate how incredibly talented some of these players are until well down the line. And I even think back, you know, speaking of 25 years ago, I've brought up this topic before, the offensive prowess of the 1993 Toronto Blue Jays. Talking about players who almost hit 400, there were three guys in that lineup who for much of the 93 season were hitting over 350 And they eventually cooled off a little bit, but they still ended up over 300. But you had a lineup that included Ricky Henderson and Paul Molitor and Roberto Alomar and John Olerud and, Devon White was smacking the ball around and Joe Carter was hitting the ball well. And, guys like Pat Borders are, consistently contributing, to that 93 Blue Jays team. But especially the top of that order, Alomar and Olerud and Henderson and Molitor and Carter, it's amazing some of the hitting that the 93 Blue Jays have. But you didn't really appreciate that until just a few years ago when people are getting excited about, hey, this guy's hitting 298. Well, big deal. The Jays had five guys over 320, in certain points of the 93 season. So I think that's part of it, too, is that, the word boring, I dropped it in there, again, kind of off the cuff, but it wasn't a hit set in 1959. But over time, first with the increased reverence that we have for Ted Williams and his exploits on and off the field now, and the fact that he is still, even many years after his passing, is a deity in especially the New England area, now you can look back at that set and go, wow, this is actually pretty good. And also, as a collector, I think we appreciate the artwork on here. These were colorized black and white photographs from Ted's career and life. And Fleer actually did a very nice job of colorizing them. They're a very simple, clean design. And also from a financial standpoint, because the set was not extremely popular in 1959, there is some value to it. There is some scarcity. And oh, by the way, there is added scarcity because technically it is an 80-card set, but early in the printing run, Fleer had to pull a card, card number 68. It's called Ted Signs, and it's a picture of Ted Williams signing a contract with Bucky Harris, the general manager of the Boston Red Sox. And the reason why Fleer had to pull this card early in the production was because not only was Ted Williams still under contract with Topps at the time, but Bucky Harris was still under contract with Topps at the time. So this was one of the many court battles that Topps had with Fleer in the 1950s and 1960s resulted in some action here. Fleer had to make a few changes as to what they were doing. So they had to pull that card, and because that card is missing from the set, and there's reportedly just a handful that are out there, maybe a few hundred, not that many. But there's obviously some value to that card, and that one card often greatly increases the value of a complete set. But that's another reason why Fleer had some trouble with it, because once again, the Topps lawyers got in the way, and they had to make some changes on their end and put out an incomplete set here. But, to get back to the original thought here, Robert, again, I stand corrected on the Red Sox word marks. They were used in that set there. And I think now you look at the set, it's a very nice set. It's a neat historical timeline of Ted Williams' life up until almost the end of his playing career. And it is a nice set and something that we as collectors go out to find now, not only because it's well done and it's a very popular player, but also there is some scarcity. So there's the excitement of the chase of trying to pull that set together. And if you do get a complete set, and it is in a very good condition, or I shouldn't say very good, but if it's in a mint or near mint condition, you can value that at, I've seen some sets, just doing a little research, $5,000-$6,000. And of course, if you go through the PSA process of grading every card, which will set you back a few $100, but that does increase the value as well. So if you're fortunate to put together a complete 59 Fleer Ted Williams set, and it's in decent shape, you've got yourself a pretty valuable set there. It just wasn't seen that way in 1959 because kids, who were the primary target audience of the baseball card hobby at the time, just weren't interested in watching Ted Williams sign a contract or go fishing or serve his country. They wanted baseball. This was the golden era of the sport here. Attendance was booming. Teams were getting popular. There were some great Hall of Fame players out there. The game was all over television at the time, and they just didn't want to see Ted Williams. They wanted to see everybody else there. So that's kind of the original thought process to my boring comment. Now, thanks everybody for chiming in, not only on our previous episode, but as we will discuss in a moment, a lot of the topics from our current episode, and you can do that on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, so on to the topics at hand this week, and it is centered around our 1983 Donruss set. And once again, it's Heavy J getting the conversation going when we had mentioned that the 83 Donruss packs were the ones that we were going to open. He says, not really a question, but it always bothered me that 83 was so similar to the 82 design and that 81, 82, 83 were all really boring. There's that B word again. Meanwhile, 85 Donruss is one of my two favorite sets of the 80s. Did they hire someone awesome? Did their 81, 83 crew finally become inspired? Any idea? Well, yes, Heavy. Actually, this is something that I've talked a little more in depth about Fleer and their struggles. But before we talk about some of the players that we pulled from this 83 Donruss wax pack break, let me give you a little background about the Donruss company. Donruss was actually founded in the early 1950s by brothers Donald and Russell Wiener. And they started a company, much like many other companies that eventually dabbled in baseball cards. They were a confectionery company. They made candy. They made bubble gum. So it's a very similar start to Topps baseball cards, to Bowman baseball cards, Fleer baseball cards. They started in the candy industry, and they just decided to, at one point in time, diversify and eventually get into producing trading cards. Now, the Donruss Company got its name from Donald and Russell combining their first names together. I think that was a wise choice instead of saying Wiener baseball cards, because nobody, you know, wants to trade Wieners, really. Well, maybe some people who are envious of others, but, you know, you don't go out and buy a pack of Wieners and trade those. No, you know, we're going to go out and get some Donruss, right? And it's also definitely a much better name for bubble gum. Hey, are you chewing on some Wiener? I would think not. Donruss became a trading card company after getting a start as a maker of sweet treats. And they dabbled in some sports cards, although they were niche sports, like auto racing, things like that. And they really found their success in the entertainment industry, which is very interesting because, you know, Topps and Bowman are the leaders, not only in baseball, but also other sports cards that are being made at the time. Fleer is constantly trying to get their foot in the door with baseball and other sports, but they're running into, you know, a lot of the legal headaches that Topps would throw at them. But Donruss was finding success in making small card sets based on television shows and movies. And they really just found this little niche in the 1960s and going into the 1970s, and they were perfectly fine with that. Meanwhile, starting in 1974, after numerous skirmishes with Topps, Fleer finally decides to go to war. Okay, we're going to challenge Topps and their monopoly. They can't be the only company that can create a baseball card. We're going to go after them. And it took Fleer 6 years to finally win with a landmark decision in the federal court system in the United States in 1980, the late summer of 1980, where the court said Topps was a monopoly and they had to not only give Fleer the opportunity to sell baseball cards that were officially licensed by Major League Baseball and the Players Association, but there was a time window where Topps had to allow competition to come in, and Major League Baseball and the Players Association had to look at other possible entries into the hobby. And I will also reference at this point in time our first podcast on 1980 Topps. Go through the archives. Look for the 80 Topps episode featuring Len Barker. That was our random poll from that episode. And you'll have to go back a little bit. This is probably a year and a half or so ago. But I really go in depth on the hard hobby back then. I really go back into the archives there and explain the whole process from 1974 to 1980. So if you really want the detailed story, that's where you can find it. But again, the short version of the story is that while Fleer did all the heavy lifting and did all the battling in court and ultimately was the winner, again, the courts opened up a window here that said Major League Baseball and the Players Association had to consider other players, including Fleer and Topps. So the people at Donruss go, hey, you know, we've done a little bit of sports and, well, we've been producing cards for 20 or so years. Let's give it a shot. And what do you know? Donruss becomes one of the three approved, officially licensed baseball card sets for the upcoming 1981 release. So Donruss just kind of sneaks in through the back door here, and now all of a sudden, they are major players. And now all of a sudden, they've got to produce some baseball cards. And that's where a lot of the trouble starts. And Fleer had a lot of the same issues, but because Fleer had been producing cloth stickers and because they had tried to go head-to-head with Topps a few times before, not just in 1959 with the Ted Williams set, but in 1960, Fleer had an all-time great set that went out. They really went head-to-head in 1963, and of course, Topps throws the hammer down at them in court, and Fleer has to stop mid-production of creating that set. By the way, I'll probably do a show on 63 Fleer one of these days. I got to get my hands on some of those cards, but I've always found that set and the story behind it to be very interesting. But anyways, you know, Fleer had at least a toe in the water with baseball and producing sports cards before, but it wouldn't be so fortunate for Donruss. And they were way, way, way behind in the game. Some of the same issues that Fleer had, that Donruss had, was that in the 25-year monopoly of Topps, Topps not only owned the market in terms of what consumers were buying, but they also knew how to work every angle. They knew the wholesalers. They knew who to speak to at every grocery chain, every drugstore chain, as hobby shops started becoming, baseball card outlets. They knew how to, sell this stuff to baseball card stores and baseball card shows. And they really owned the industry. So it was very hard for Fleer and Donruss to break down some of those walls early on. So even though they were making sets, they weren't very well distributed. They weren't very well marketed. A lot of people in certain parts of the country didn't even know about Fleer and Donruss until the mid-1980s. So that was a big problem. Also, while a company like Donruss had enough infrastructure to make small sets for, the Monkees TV show or, a popular movie at the time, they didn't really have the infrastructure to make a 660 card set in mass quantities and get it out there. So there were all sorts of capital expenses. Well, now we've got to buy more printing presses, and now we've got to, install new production lines. And then there's logistical issues. Well, now we've got to, how do we lay these cards out so there aren't double printings? How do we cut these things? How do we, mix the cards up so that you don't have, four Reggie Jackson cards showing up in one pack? How do we distribute it? How's the warehouse system? How do we get it into the stores? There's a whole lot of issues. And then on top of that, how do you market it? How do you, what's the price point? What's the extra, bonus cards that we throw in on top of the base cards? Basically, Topps had not only cornered the market and owned every nook and cranny of it for 25 years, but Fleer and Donruss had roughly 6 months to kind of figure all of this out. And in fact, that 6 month is basically from when the court case came out to where a set would be released. Realistically, they only had about 3 or 4 months to actually put this plan into action. So when you consider that, the fact that Fleer and Donruss even had a set in 1981 is pretty remarkable. But They were rather sets, especially when you compare it to what Topps was putting out at the time. Now, 81 FLIR I've always liked because it was a pretty adequate set. Like, if you had to grade it on a letter scale, 81 FLIR, in my opinion, you give it a C+. It's not great, but okay, it'll do. Donruss in 81, D-. It's just not a very good set. And in fact, the only reason why you don't give it an F is because they managed to get something out. You know, it's kind of like your teacher giving you 10 points on your quiz because you spelled your name right. So 81 Donruss really was behind the eight ball. They had poor cardstock quality. They had a very clunky design, not only on the front, but the back. You know, the back of the card had kind of a timeline narrative as to a player's history and just 1 year of stats. It was, you know, listed vertically, and this is back when baseball cards had pretty much stuck with a horizontal presentation, with the exception of 75 Tops. Horizontal was pretty much the way to go ever since the late 1960s. And it just didn't look good. The photography was terrible. And that's another roadblock. You know, Topps had all of the top photographers, not only in New York and the East Coast, but on the West Coast as well. They had a base of operations in the San Francisco, Oakland area. So they had the best photographers, the best way of, processing film and getting the good shots. While Donruss was literally going out and just finding, freelancers. And it's well known that Keith Olbermann, longtime ESPN personality, and he actually is part owner, or he's an investor, I should say, in Topps and one of their historians. But Keith Olbermann actually has, I think it's like 15 photographs of players that he took at ballparks in the late 70s are used in the 81 Donruss set. He's responsible for a handful of the photos that you see in that set there. So, you know, Donruss is taking pictures from teenagers, you know, paying him a few bucks to get that out there. So, you know, 81 Donruss was a debacle. I thought 82 Donruss was a much needed improvement. The cardstock was a little better. The design on the front was cleaner. Photography was still an issue at the time. The design on the back was much, much nicer. But getting to Heavy J's point, the 83 set, Donruss pretty much played it safe. They're like, okay, we settled it down. We got something good out there in 82. They just did a few tweaks. You know, in 82, I call it the clip art set because it just looks like they just cut and paste a few things to design the card. You had a baseball bat and a baseball at the base of the card that had, you know, the player's name across the bat, his position, and then on the ball, it was stamped the team name. Well, in 83, they basically just turned the bat around 180 degrees. You have the player's name and position, and instead of a ball, you have a glove with the team name stamped in it. Not very inventive, considering what 82 produced. The backs are pretty much the same in presentation. The big difference is they just changed the color from a dark blue background to kind of a goldenrod background. And Donruss would use essentially the same design in 1984, although they changed the color to this kind of emerald green color. And it isn't very innovative. You look at Topps, they put out a great set in 83. It would be the start of a very nice run for Topps in the mid to late 80s. FLIR, I think, put out one of their better efforts in 83, despite the fact that their photos were still dealing with darkness and graininess. I think considering how low of a bar FLIR set in 82, FLIR actually went backwards. You know, if you gave 81 FLIR a C+, I think 82 FLIR is a D-. It's just a terrible set. But in 83, they kind of moved back to maybe a C+, B- range. And 83 would be the start of a nice long stretch of really nice cards that FLIR put out there. But Donruss was still lagging. 1984 would be the year for Donruss. And in fact, I think you look at 1983 for the hobby, I liken it to the final 10 seconds of a rocket launch or a space shuttle launch. You remember those? You know, about T-minus 10 seconds, the booster rockets are firing up, the vessel's shaking, you're starting to get some smoke from underneath the launch pad. We're ready to go, you know, ready for liftoff. 83 was kind of that year. The card industry was just about to take off, which it would in 84, and it would be so successful in the mid to late 80s that Major League Baseball and the Players Association, which were constantly clashing back in the 1980s. You know, baseball's had relative labor stability over the last 20 years now. That might change in a few years, but you forget how often the players and the owners were at odds with one another. But one thing that they could agree on, hey, these baseball cards, they're making us some money. We need to expand this. And that, of course, led to the creation of the Score and Upper Deck and the reintroduction of Bowman and then kind of the beginning of the junk wax era in the late 1980s and early 1990s. But 1983 was kind of that T-minus 10 seconds moment. And it wasn't just because Topps had a great set, Fleer had a much improved set, Donruss had at least found some stability if it wasn't a very creative set. But yeah, the holy trinity of rookie cards, which really started the rookie card craze. Yes, before Tony Gwynn and Wade Boggs and Ryan Sandberg came around in 83, you also had Ron Kittle in 83. A lot of people were chasing the Kittle cards back then. But also, you had Cal Ripken Jr. in 82. You had Ricky Henderson in 1980. You had, Tim Raines, Kirk Gibson in 1981. You had some good rookie cards then, but it was with the, Gwynn, Boggs, and Sandberg in 83 that really got the rookie card craze going, followed by Don Mattingly in 1984. And then by then, you've got the rated rookies in Donruss. Topps is really putting the focus on the little rookie cup cards that they had done in past years, but now they're trying to guess who's going to be a star. You know, they created the future stars cards, and Fleer at the same time would have Fleer prospects. Donruss would create the rookies subset in 1986. So, 1983 kind of got the ball rolling here for the rookie chases, whether it was a rookie card in a base set, whether it was a rookie set later in the decade, or if it was dropping in rookie cards in the update or traded sets that were released late in the season. 83 Donruss, a 660-card set, technically 653 player cards and 7 checklist cards. The big cards, of course, are Boggs and Gwynn and Sandberg, as well as early career cards for Ripken and Henderson and Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker and Robin Yount and George Brett and all the other stars from the mid to late 70s and onward. Speaking of Alan Trammell, he was one of the big cards that we got from this pull. Also, Pete Rose was in there as well as Paul Molitor. Three cards that are certainly not bad, valued at, I would guess, probably a couple dollars a piece if you're not grading them. If you put them through the grading process, maybe you can mark them up to $10. So certainly nothing that's going to pay the mortgage, but some nice little pieces there. But other than that, in our break, a lot of common cards there. So it's a little frustrating, but that's kind of the yin and the yang of the 83 card set. You either hit the mother load with one of those big rookie cards, or you get some Hall of Fame worthy players, but nothing that's really going to increase the value of your set. With that said, if we're giving letter grades to sets, I would give 83 Donruss a C+. Like I said, they played it safe in 83. After the 81 debacle, they put together a pretty decent set in 82 and just decided, all right, let's just keep it kind of the way it is, even though it wasn't a very innovative leap from 82 to 83. It was a safe bet, and I think when you look back at all the hurdles that Donruss and Fleer had to overcome in those first 3 years, it was actually the right move for Donruss to make. And then they put out a really good set in 84. And then they had some great sets. As we mentioned when we opened the 85 Rack Pack several episodes ago, you could argue that 85 Donruss is the best set from their early collection days. And I'm not talking about, the Panini days of, the last several years. I think when you look at the original Donruss baseball card, 85 is probably the best design, frustrating design because of the black borders, but certainly a lot of star power there and just a really beautiful card. And Donruss put out some really good sets in 86 and 87. I'm one of the few champions of the design of 88 Donruss. I'm not as offended by it as many collectors are. But, 88 Donruss was okay. 89 Donruss was pretty good. 90 Donruss was another debacle, the catch-up card, if you will. And, after that, 91 Donruss, I liked it. It was kind of quirky, but as we've had, I think it was P.K. Steinberg called it the Christmas sweater set. Yeah, it does have that kind of a Cosby Show sweater look to it. It's not very good. But much like a lot of the other big name card companies from the 1980s, Donruss tried to go premium with the base set in 1992. But by then, even though they had greatly improved the set, much like every other baseball card company at the time, the Leaf Company, which owned Donruss, had turned their focus into the other premium sets, mainly Leaf and also the Leaf Studio sets. And they poured a lot of money in trying to make those premium sets more of the base sets. And the base Donruss set kind of withered on the vine for many years after. The Donruss brand is back out now as Panini. They are not officially licensed by baseball, so they're not using word marks and logos. I've never been a big fan of that. Some of the Donruss products that are out there now are basically just playing off the design from the 1980s sets. Some people like that, me, not so much. And, this is coming from somebody who loves the Topps Heritage sets. I'm not a big fan of Donruss basically just taking some of the old designs and turning it into a cookie cutter contest. But 83 Donruss, not so bad. And you can still get packs and boxes at relatively decent prices. And hey, if you pick up maybe 5 or 6 packs at a card show or a hobby shop, and you're probably only paying $20, $25 for these things, collectively, I mean, you shouldn't be paying more than $5 or $6 a pack for these things. But, if you get a good deal on some packs, who knows? You land one of those big three rookie cards there, or a Ripken or a Henderson, you may be able to very easily get your money back, and I think you'll appreciate the set a little more just because you actually have some pretty decent cards from it. Now, even though we didn't get decent cards from our sets, or from our packs, I should say, we did get some pretty fun cards here. So I'm going to go through rather quickly some of the interesting player cards that we got out of this. Ron Hassey, I kind of chuckled at this card because Ron Hassey was your stereotypical catcher. He was just a big, stocky catcher. Spent most of his career with Cleveland, but also played for the Cubs, the Yankees, the White Sox, the A's, and the Expos. Won a World Series with the A's in 1989. And one very interesting point to Ron Hassey's career, he is the only catcher in Major League Baseball history to have caught more than one perfect game. That's amazing. He caught Len Barker's perfect game with Cleveland against Toronto in 1981. And then he caught Denny Martinez's perfect game with the Expos against the Dodgers in 1991. He's also the second catcher in Major League history to have caught a no-hitter in both leagues. That, I thought, was very, very interesting. Hassey, after his playing days, would go into the coaching world, as he was a coach for the Rockies in their first 3 seasons. Later on, with the St. Louis Cardinals, was also a scout with the Arizona Diamondbacks, and was up until a few years ago managing in AAA in New Orleans, which is the Miami Marlins' top farm club. But he has since retired even from the coaching ranks several years ago. But I thought that was very interesting about Ron Hassey. That's a great trivia question. If you say, name the only catcher to have caught 2 perfect games in Major League history, who are you thinking of? Hey, maybe it's Yogi Berra or Carlton Fisk or Thurman Munson. I mean, you can name all these great catchers off the top of your head. No, it's actually Ron Hassey, of all people. Greg Minton. I love the Greg Minton card simply because every time you see a Greg Minton card, you think of the Greg Minton card. You know which one I'm talking about. 78 tops, or as I love to call it, the Velvet Elvis card. One of the worst airbrushed cards in the history of Major League Baseball card history. This isn't a 78 tops Greg Minton, but we did get the 83 Donruss. You know, despite having the Velvet Elvis baseball card, Greg Minton actually had a pretty phenomenal career despite having a major injury early in his career. He was able to play over 16 seasons and became a very reliable relief pitcher, spent most of his career with the Giants, was an all-star for the team in 1982, and is actually part of the Giants' Wall of Fame. He would conclude his career with the California Angels, and he has a very unique nickname. No, not Velvet Elvis baseball card. No, his nickname is Moon Man, because apparently Greg Minton was a little bit of a lunatic, according to his biography. Very early on in his career, he would hijack the team bus, or he decided to flood a minor league ballpark so that he could leave Amarillo one day early at the end of the season. So there you go, the Moon Man, or as I say, Velvet Elvis baseball card guy, Greg Minton. Wally Backman, I love the picture of Wally Backman from the 83 Donruss set, because you can see him. He's clearly looking around like either he's not up to any good or a teammate is up to no good. And since he got his career going with the Mets in the 1980s, it could be either or both of those two. He is one of the underrated cogs of the 86 Mets and those dominant Mets teams in the mid to late 80s. He and Wally Backman platooning in the infield of Tim Tuffle as well. A very, very good, efficient, consistent middle infield trio that, again, either guy could play second or shortstop in a pinch. And Davey Johnson certainly used him to their best effort there. After the Mets bouncing around a little bit, Twins, Pirates, Phillies, later the Mariners, retiring in 1993. Unfortunately for Wally Backman, he is best known in his post-playing days as the manager who never was. After the 2004 season, the Arizona Diamondbacks named Backman as their manager, and he had been a minor league manager and a well-regarded minor league manager for many, many years going into this season. In fact, in 2004, he was the Sporting News Minor League Manager of the Year after an 86-54 record with the Lancaster Jethawks. So the Diamondbacks naturally go, oh, well, we just need to promote him. But then the stories come out that he had been arrested for DUI. He was arrested for a domestic abuse incident. He also had some trouble with the IRS. So all of this comes out in HBO's Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. And excuse me. So all of this comes out all at once, and some people may have thought it was kind of a hit job in New York. There were some people that resented Backman, so they got the stories out there of his past and some shady deals. And just 4 days after they hired him, the Diamondbacks had to cut ties with him. They admitted that they didn't really do their homework on him. So unfortunately, Backman has been relegated to minor league manager ever since, and in more recent years has been a manager in the Mexican Baseball League. So kind of a tragic story there, but one of those situations, and you see it every now and then, where there's this high-profile hire, and then all of a sudden these skeletons come out of the closet, and it just becomes a real mess. I mentioned Mike Witt. That was one of the first cards that we pulled from the packs here, and didn't have Ron Hassey catch his no-hitter or perfect game, but he was involved in both. Pitched a perfect game on the last day of the 1984 season and was part of a combined no-hitter in April of 1990 with the California Angels. The Angels, you look back at their pitching rotation in the late 80s and early 90s. You had Mark Langston was in there. You had Chuck Finley. You had Jim Abbott. But Mike Witt is a guy that you kind of forget about. He was a very dominant pitcher. You could say the ace of the team rotation for the mid-80s. Two-time All-Star in 1986 and 87. A member of the Angels Hall of Fame. Also an all-county basketball player when he was in high school, fourth round draft pick in the 1978 Major League Draft. Unfortunately for him, his arm started getting worn out as the 80s progressed into the 90s. And even though he wasn't much of a factor in the Yankees rotation in the early 90s, he was the guy who could finally relieve the burden of Dave Winfield from George Steinbrenner, as Winfield was traded for Witt back in May of 1990. And while Witt's career would go down, Winfield was able to revive his career kind of in anonymity because the Angels weren't that great in the early 90s. Eventually, he would go on to sign a free agent contract with the Blue Jays in 1992 and win a World Series there. But Mike Witt, one of those often overlooked and forgotten pitchers from that time. Another guy who is often overlooked and forgotten as a pitcher, and he shouldn't be because he was a very consistent pitcher, the old southpaw Jerry Royce played 22 years in the big leagues, managed to win 220 games. In fact, he is one of only two pitchers in Major League history to have won over 200 games without having a 20-win season. His career started with the St. Louis Cardinals in 1969, had a contract squabble with the Cardinals, so they dump him onto the Houston Astros, and it's starting in Houston in the early 70s that he starts to find his groove. Later plays for the Pirates in the mid to late 70s, lands in Los Angeles in 1979, wins a World Series with them in 1981, and rounds out his career bouncing around from teams in Cincinnati, the Angels, the White Sox, the Brewers, the Pirates, but two-time All-Star in 75 with Pittsburgh, 80 with the Dodgers, also pitched a no-hitter against the Giants in June of 1980. He is now a broadcaster, has been a member of the Dodgers broadcast team for many, many years now, but also is partially known for his photography skills, as if you look through any old picture or any picture of an older stadium or maybe a stadium that's since been closed or demolished, there's a good chance that Jerry Royce took those pictures. And in fact, I think it was during 1988, he would get to the ballpark early and he would take 20 or 30 pictures of some of the older stadiums. I'm talking like Municipal Stadium in Cleveland, County Stadium in Milwaukee, Exhibition Stadium in Toronto. So he took a lot of pictures of the American League ballparks because he was pitching in the American League at the time. And there's a great collection of photographs from these late 1980s ballparks that are out on the internet that Jerry Royce took. And he took them from all angles. Like if you look at Municipal Stadium in Cleveland, he went to the very top seat in the very far corner of the, you know, right field upper deck seats. It's just some amazing camera work that he did to kind of offer a perspective of stadiums from a fan's point of view. Now, a guy who may have been playing at Exhibition Stadium at some point in Jerry Royce's career, Buck Martinez, also better known as a broadcaster now. He was a color commentator for many, many years after his playing career. Became a manager in Toronto in 2001, part of the 2002 season, then went back into broadcasting. He's now a play-by-play announcer for the Blue Jays. But Buck Martinez, a member of the Kansas City Royals, an original member of the Royals in 1969, didn't really have a stellar standout career. In fact, was not only a backup catcher, but was one of those bubble guys who would, you know, kind of almost be optioned to the minor leagues at any moment. And that would be the case too in Milwaukee too in the late 70s. Finally found a home backing up Ernie Witt in Toronto in the early 80s. Suffered a really gruesome leg injury in a home plate collision in the 1985 season when he was bowled over by Phil Bradley in Seattle. Still, despite having his ankle broken, he was still able to get Gorman Thomas out at the plate in the rather routine 9-2-7-2 double play with George Bell providing some of the defensive heroics in the game as well. But Buck Martinez was one of those guys who talk about almost like not a minor league lifer, but a platoon catcher. Took him a good almost 15 years before he finally got somewhat of a consistent appearance behind the plate. Ken Urbeck, you know, I made this joke while opening the cards, you know, the Ken Urbeck, and we had the Diamond King Ken Urbeck card. He was one of the schlubby twins, and I don't mean that as a knock, even though schlubby is not a term of endearment. But when you think of Ken Urbeck at first base for the Twins and Gary Gaetti at third base for the Twins in the 80s, you had the big uglies at the corners. These were not very attractive gentlemen here, but boy, they were some really good baseball players. Ken Urbeck, a Minnesota, in fact, Minneapolis native, played his entire career from 1981 to 94 with the Twins, was an all-star for them in 82. Hit the first home run in the Metrodome, oh, by the way. Also won two World Series with them in 87 and 91. His number 14 is retired. And even though he may not have been a good-looking guy, he is still an anchor in the Minnesota, Minneapolis area. And because his father passed away from ALS back in 1982, he and his family have been very, very, very big drivers of the Minnesota and Dakota chapter of the ALS Association. So great work by Kent Herbeck there. Even though, like I said, he may not have been the most attractive guy, he was a hell of a ball player and is still contributing a lot to not only the Minneapolis community, but also the ALS Association. And finally, one of the players I picked out here there were a lot of great players for the Montreal Expos. You look back and, you know, Tim Raines is in the Hall of Fame, and you think of Andre Dawson and Gary Carter. But there were a lot of players who, because they played for the Expos, didn't quite get the due that they deserve. You know, Danny Martinez is one that I think of. And who else? You know, Larry Walker, too. I mean, Larry Walker's loved in Montreal. But, you know, Walker didn't really have that attention rightly deserved for him until he got to Colorado and later St. Louis. But Tim Wallach is definitely one of those guys, an all-star third baseman for the Expos. I really admired his prowess. He was a solid hitter, two-time Silver Slugger Award winner in the mid-80s, but also an outstanding defenseman at third base as well. Three-time Gold Glove winner in 85, 88, and 90. Five-time all-star for the Expos. Golden Spikes Award winner in 1979. A guy who had a career .257 batting average, but also 260 home runs, 1,125 RBI over a very solid 17-season career. After a lengthy stint with the Expos, he was with the Dodgers for a little bit, went over to Anaheim with the Angels, went back to the Dodgers where he concluded his playing career in 1996, and he would go the coaching route too, first through the minor leagues, but was a longtime coach for the Dodgers and is now a bench coach for former Dodger manager Don Mattingly in Miami with the Marlins. So some fun stories from some of the cards that we got in the 83 Donruss packs. You know, like I said, you get Pete Rose and you get Alan Trammell and you get Paul Molitor. So some nice cards, but yeah, not the Holy Trinity, not the big rookies we were looking for, but we'll live without it. It's okay. Again, if you would like to make a cash contribution to provide us with some of the great packs that we get to open here or some of the older cards that we're able to purchase and look over, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Make your donation and we will put it to good use, if not in the purchase of cards that we discuss on the show, but in maintaining the Wax Ecstatic database of new and archived shows as well. Again, our next show will be coming out 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, November the 16th, and we will have a video review of the cards. Again, at this moment, I don't know if we're going to do another pack break or if I stumble upon some single cards that we can look over, but we will have a video link coming out the previous Thursday. That will be November 15th, so look for that on YouTube. And of course, we link everything up to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And Wax and Gum Stains, main driver for a lot of the conversation in this week's show. So keep the conversation going. Share the account with your friends. Let your friends who either collect now or collected back in the day know about Wax Ecstatic as we come your way every other Friday throughout the off season via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again so much for joining us here on Wax Ecstatic, and we will see you next time.